Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Federal Insurance Company against Arthur Anderson. Mr. Constein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Our appeal raises a number of questions. The first that I would like to address is whether Anderson incurred a loss at all, and whether in the absence of a loss, there can be a right to recovery of insurance proceeds. We believe the district court erred in holding that Anderson's settlement with its retired partners, by which Anderson agreed to continue paying retirement benefits in exchange for a substantial reduction in the amount of benefits, was a loss to Anderson. Multiple recent rulings, including this court's decision in Level 3 Communications versus Federal, the May decision, and other rulings, make clear that such a payment is not a loss. The Level 3 court stated the issue plainly. The interpretive principle for which Federal contends, that a loss within the meaning of an insurance contract does not include an ill-gotten gain, is clearly right, quoting from the court's opinion. The same principle applies here and requires reversal of the district court's order and judgment in Federal's favor. Now, reduced to its essentials, the relevant sequence of events can properly be described as follows. For decades, Anderson had made retirement payments pursuant to a partnership agreement that governed those payments, and also pursuant to various alleged customs, practices, and representations, all of which were alleged to be part of that written contract. As of October 2002, Anderson was continuing to make those payments and did so in November as well.
I suppose one of the points Anderson is making, though, is that that's not the only way this can be construed, and that, in fact, there's a dissipation of assets theory that perhaps is enough to trigger the duty to defend at a minimum.
Yes, Your Honor, we disagree with that. In fact, that is, from a review of the record, clearly not the case. There were only, I guess there are two perspectives, two ways of looking at it. One is, were such allegations in the record at all? And there are only two instances in which they are in the record. One is the Buchholz-Bryce case seeks injunctive relief to prevent Anderson from dissipating its assets. It does not assert a claim for damages for dissipation of assets.
But is that a little too picky, though, if the concept of dissipation of assets is in there, at least, and you are entitled to whatever relief you're entitled to?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because of really my second point, which is that what matters is who is making the payments here. Anderson is the only one who made payments. The claims against Anderson were, we are entitled to those payments because Anderson promised them to us in this partnership agreement, arguably as modified by various representations and practices. But the gravamen of the claim is, we are entitled to these payments from Anderson. Why Anderson isn't making the payments is completely irrelevant to the nature of the claims that are being asserted. In other words, it wouldn't make sense for the plaintiffs to make a claim against Anderson that Anderson dissipated assets and therefore couldn't pay what it had agreed to pay under the contract. The only thing that made sense was for them to argue Anderson owes us money under this contract and hasn't paid us. And so, in fact, that was the only allegation, or those were the only types of allegations that were made. The injunctive relief claim, therefore, couldn't have provided a basis, or wouldn't logically provide a basis for a separate damages claim when the claim is you breached the contract.
So it sounds to me like you're arguing that even if one were to look over to the Buchholz-Bryce complaint and litigation, it wouldn't fundamentally change the scope of the current claims that are at issue.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Even if one looked at Buchholz-Bryce as articulating the claims that were settled in this case, it wouldn't change the nature of the claims for two reasons. One, because to the extent alleged dissipation, it was only seeking to prevent it, not asserting it as a damage claim. But second, it did not and would not make sense for the plaintiffs to assert it as a damage claim, because fundamentally the claim is Anderson didn't pay money that it owed. And What happened in this case is essentially that Anderson, in October of 2002, said to the insured, said to its partners, retirees, after years of making payments, and after saying we have committed to make payments through November, we're not going to make these payments anymore, but we will negotiate with you a proposal to continue making these payments, but at a reduced rate. And that is nothing but, and that certainly cannot be characterized as a loss.
But Anderson, as I also understand it, argues that there was no contractual obligation to make any payment, which is why they were able to say, yes, maybe we paid one thing in the past, now we're going to pay a smaller amount going forward. But if there was no contractual obligation to make the payment, then how does it fit into your theory?
Well, that argument doesn't change the outcome for several reasons. Fundamentally, this court recognized in Level 3 and other courts that have dealt with this issue, for example, the local 705 versus five-star case, which is an Illinois appellate decision, the Reliance case that we cite in our brief, and numerous other cases that have dealt with this issue and are cited in our brief, almost invariably involve settlements of disputed claims. The reasoning that, for example, Judge Posner used in the Level 3 decision was the idea that it's a contested claim and therefore it was a settlement and somehow falls outside of the idea of being not a loss, can't be right, to quote his language. And the reason is because the settlement payment, I mean, the reasoning in Level 3, which I think also applies squarely here, is this was not a nuisance settlement. Now, in Level 3, there was a $12 million settlement. The court said that's not an inconsiderable amount and reflects that there was some exposure that motivated the payment. And in that case, it was one-fifth of the overall amount claimed. In this case, there were $648 million in retirement payments claimed by retirees. And that's Anderson's own number that they've calculated. Their obligation shrank to $231 million in pension payments, but $231 million in pension payments is not an inconsiderable amount by any means. It's much more proportionally than was involved in the Level 3 case. So really, Anderson can't have it both ways. Either that was a completely voluntary payment, in which case it certainly wouldn't be appropriate for it to be an insurable loss. It was simply Anderson's choice. Or it was made in anticipation of a real liability, of a real possibility that they would be held to owe this money. The record bears that out, bears out the second interpretation as well, because Ms. Raimondo testified at trial, and this is in the record, that and also there is a notation of her comments to Federal, which is in the appendix. Ms. Raimondo, the general counsel of Anderson, testified that in their view there was a as high as 50% chance that Anderson would be held liable for the entire amount of $648 million. Therefore, it simply doesn't make sense for Anderson to get up and say, or write in his brief and say, we didn't owe this money. This claim had no merit. The general counsel said her lawyers told her that the claim had significant merit, up again to a possibility of a 50-50 chance of losing. And the amount that they paid, $231 million, certainly suggests that there was merit. The idea, I think, in Level 3 and again in these other cases is that you don't go behind, you don't go behind the settlement to try to determine whether or not there was merit to the claim, because if you did that, it would allow an insured a very easy out. It could settle the claim for 99% less one, or 100% less $1, or 99%, or whatever it chose to, and then say to the insured, it was a settlement, we settled it, we didn't really have liability, and get coverage, and that simply would defeat the purpose of the rule. Anderson, I would also say, Anderson really hasn't attempted, and this was also a point that was made in Level 3, to disprove the key allegations against it. Anderson has said in its brief only, if you look at the plain language of, if you look at the partnership agreement, we had the right to terminate payments. But, of course, the gravamen of the allegations was that this agreement was modified and by both a custom and practice over years and by statements made to the various partners. And Anderson never introduced, either in the summary judgment stage or at the trial stage, a single piece of evidence suggesting that those allegations were untrue and that it would prevail on those allegations. So
but
this
you
is.
I'm going to guess that Anderson is going to say that you've jumped into the case or the discussion at a point a little bit later than where they're going to, namely reasons why you might not have a duty to indemnify or a duty to cover this loss. And as I understand their argument, it is that there was enough there to trigger a duty to defend that you failed to defend in a way that was acceptable under these policies, and you are now stopped from making the kinds of arguments that you're now making.
Well, Your Honor, that certainly is their argument, that we are stopped, and we are not for a number of reasons. First, because the nature of the payment that was made was not a loss to Anderson, then estoppel really is beside the point. Judge Bauer's decision, or Judge Bauer's opinion, I should say, in this court's decision in the Platinum Technologies case, looked specifically, notwithstanding estoppel, at whether a loss existed. And the court said, you know, even if there is estoppel by virtue of having, you know, failed to timely preserve your having failed to preserve your defenses, timely defend, or whatever, that you can't, through the mechanism of estoppel, create a loss that doesn't exist. Now, in that case, there was a settlement where there was an outlay of $6 million plus, I believe, credits of $4 million. So there was a monetary outlay. And if Anderson's position were correct, it would have been beyond the power of the insurer to say, you have to look beyond that $6 million because some of that really can't be credited to our account. But in fact, the court did exactly that. The court said you have to look at that $6 million, you have to look at the value of the trademark rights that were purchased, and you have to balance them off each other. Now, in this case, the entire settlement payment is not a loss because it was essentially Anderson renegotiating its retirement arrangements with its retirees,
but
nothing more nor less.
But it seems to me, I mean, of course, this is a point of difference between you. On the one hand, there are things that are just so remote from a policy that you're not really even relying, in a sense, on the policy to make your argument that you're not covered. If Anderson was trying to get you to pay for fire damage, for example, that's not the kind of policy you wrote. It wasn't a fire policy. On the other hand, the estoppel theory suggests that if you are really relying on particularities of that policy to get off the hook, here's the definition of loss, it's this, it's not that, here is some exception to coverage, you can't both default in your duty to defend and now turn around and take advantage of policy language. I think that's the line people are groping for.
Well, Your Honor, the difference is that this is not, federal is not relying on an exclusion, it's not relying on the insuring clause. It's not relying on a definition of loss that is within the policy. This court said in Level 3 and said, I believe, in Five Star, the appellate court in Five Star, and in other cases, looked to the word loss. It said, looked to the idea of loss, I should say, not to how it was defined in the policy. In fact, the court said, we don't care how the policy defines it. There has to still be this concept that there has to be a loss. Otherwise, the insured receives a complete windfall. And this is not an argument that is bound up with the language of the policy or the terms of the policy. It's an argument that simply follows the logical notion that an insured may be entitled to recover its loss through estoppel if there is a breach of the duty to defend. But the insured is not entitled to recover a monetary outlay that is not even a loss to the insured. And that's what the court held in Platinum. I'll add one other point, and I know I'm going into my rebuttal time, but I simply wanted to mention there's another aspect to this, which is that the court's finding that federal was estopped is one that is really an error as a matter of law for two reasons. First, the facts were essentially undisputed that federal issued coverage letters, with regard to the Waters case, which is the only one in which we were found liable, but really with regard to every case except the initial tender of the Bryce complaint, which Federal was told subsequently was dismissed, but every other complaint, Federal issued a agreed to defend within 2 months of those complaints being issued. And then within 5 months, and even arguably in the case of the Waters case, 7 months, but certainly no more, and we think 5 months is the appropriate measure. No Illinois court has held that an insurer who, like Federal, not only issued letters but filed a declaratory judgment action at most 7 months after it had any notice of these claims is estopped under this draconian estoppel rule. We submit to the court it would take Illinois law far beyond where it has ever gone to hold that this rule, which essentially rewrites the contract by nature and says you don't have an entitlement to the defenses that are available under you to the contract, to apply that in a case where an insurer, within a matter of 7 months or 5 months, filed a complaint for declaratory judgment. So that's another reason, Your Honor, why the estoppel doctrine shouldn't apply here. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alan Martin for the Appellees Cross Appellants, Arthur Anderson, LLP, and Larry Gurrell. Why is it that the Illinois courts put their thumbs down on the scale when it comes to the duty to defend and enforce that, and strictly enforce it, with the estoppel to deny coverage doctrine? Why is that? It's because the insurers, first, they draft the policies, so to the extent there are any ambiguities or any questions, they control the policy and therefore can have it construed against them. But much more importantly, what the public policy is seeking to enforce, insurers are promising protection. And they are promising protection when the dark clouds gather and a policyholder finds itself in a terribly difficult situation, lawsuits, claims, what have you. In 2002, it's hard to imagine a more difficult...
I'm a little puzzled by this line of argument because both the district court and the jury found that Arthur Anderson had failed to cooperate with Federal.
Your Honor, let's start with the Waters case. That's not the case. The jury found across the board, first, that Federal breached its duty to defend and that with respect to a number of the claims, Waters, Small, Conley, Veets, that breach was not excused. And I would venture to say that in the only instance where the jury did find that the breach was excused, that was because of an instruction error, because there was a lag time between the time that Anderson received a claim or a suit and provided it to Federal. In those instances where there was a close proximity between the time that Anderson received an arbitration demand or a lawsuit and sent it on to Federal, the jury did not excuse the breach. In those instances where there was a lag time, it did. Anderson actually argued for an instruction to cure that problem because the duty to defend cannot be excused simply because of an argument of late notice. The Wausau decision from the Illinois Supreme Court is controlling on that point.
I understand the district court's opinion. District judge also thought it was very important that Arthur Anderson had refused to cooperate in the defense. My question was not simply related to late notice. It was that information was not turned over. Mayor Brown's rates were not identified. Federal was not given any opportunity to send its own defense counsel. I mean, there may or may not be answers to this, but your opening strategy of saying Arthur Anderson is this poor, picked-upon individual is very difficult to square with what appear to be the uncontested facts of this case.
Your Honor, as of September, when the submissions were being made, Federal's own claim adjuster testified that he had everything he needed in order to determine the duty to defend, had everything that was needed. So at that point, there was nothing else that was needed. That had already been provided. I think also for part of this duty to defend, for it to have substance, it has to, and for it to be meaningful, something affirmative has to be done by the insurer. And here in 2002, Federal did not take any steps to assist Anderson. You heard Mr.
But the first thing federal says, once this three-month delay or whatever it is after the initial round of questioning occurs and Anderson finally gives it some of the information, is federal says, effectively, it's okay with us for you to go forward with the defense counsel of your choice, Mayor Brown. And surely you would agree that that is one way that an insurer is entitled to comply with its duty to defend. It doesn't have to take over the defense if it says we'll pay the bills of the people who are defending.
In fact, the one exception to estoppel that the Illinois Supreme Court has recognized in the Wausau decision, it's the only one that has been recognized, is where there's a conflict of interest. If an insurer is raising reservations, then the policyholder will not have an assigned counsel. It will have its own independent counsel.
But what does that have to do with it if when, just to take a case, forget about this case, in a case, if an insured party tenders a defense to the insurance company, and the insurance company says, it's okay with us for you to go out and pick your own defense lawyers, and we'll pay the bills. Why isn't that perfectly okay?
Well, they have to then actually go ahead and act on that
and
pay
the
bills.
Well, but they did, and here we run into the problem that no one gave them any Mayor Brown bills for a very long time.
Well, they were still, there was an issue of whether or not they, in fact, were agreeing to provide a defense. And to this day, you know, you can't simply take the Central Mutual v. Kamerling case. There the insurer said, oh, I'm going to agree to defend, and at a point I may raise a declaratory judgment action. There were 6 months before it did anything. It was viewed breach and a stop to deny coverage. Here, what happened was federal, those did not unequivocally and clearly agree to provide a defense. And even as we sit here today, take the Waters case. Mr. Constein got up and said, well, we agreed to defend. In Kamerling, it was 6 months. Here we are 6 years later, and federal still hasn't paid on the Waters case. You have to take substantive action. There's been an adjudication of the duty to defend.
Now I'm lost. Are you saying that as a matter of Illinois law, an insurance company must pay out even after it's filed a federal declaratory judgment action?
Once it agrees to provide a defense, it needs to reimburse the policyholder until such time as a court declares that it does not have an obligation. That is the General Agents versus Midwest Sporting Goods decision. It can't somehow put off breach and estoppel by saying, okay, we'll defend, and then do nothing about it.
I thought Illinois law was that the insurer always had the privilege of filing a declaratory judgment action. I understand the district court's rationale in the Waters case, the only one where Arthur Anderson was held liable. The thing that got Arthur Anderson liable was that it didn't file the federal action until 8 months had passed after the Waters suit began, not that it was refusing to pay after it had filed the federal action. Am I misunderstanding?
No, that was the case, that it did not file a timely declaratory judgment action.
Well, that's the only one where they were held liable. Now, I'd like to pursue the question about what happened in Waters. What were the damages in the Waters action?
What the Waters claimants were asserting was that there had been a point in time where there was a plan, the Anderson plan, where they had in the past been able to claim benefits. Those benefits were not presently due. As you know from the partnership agreement, the only way that benefits would be paid would be if there were net assets or net income at Anderson at a given point in time.
But, you know, here's my issue with that. I know you've made that argument, but it seems clear to me that the position of the plaintiffs in Waters, not to mention the other cases, was to the contrary, that in fact there was an obligation on Anderson's part to pay. And that's the classic stuff of litigation. One side says there's a duty, the other side says there's no duty, and so eventually the case is settled. It seems to me in that context we can't look at it as if it's only Arthur Anderson's position. There may well have been a duty to pay. And if there was, then why isn't this something that's simply a contractual matter outside the scope of this type of insurance policy?
Well, even in the Waters case, the plaintiffs asserted that irrespective of the agreement, that Anderson had made affirmative representations to it and it advised it in such a way about how the system would operate or how things would operate that they wouldn't have suffered damages but for that conduct. And that's the classic stuff of which fiduciary duty is involved. The federal policy covers not just ERISA, not just claims of breach of fiduciary duty, but errors or omissions in the administration of a plan. And that includes advising the beneficiaries of the plan. Here they're claiming not that they were owed benefits due. Part of their claim was that but for what we were told, we would have taken different steps. And now the assets have been dissipated. They will not be there in the future. And any time that you have a claim, I don't see the one thing I have a real problem with respect to federal's position is any time you have a dispute that relates to a benefit plan, at some point the claim damages are going to have to link back to some benefits. If it's mismanagement, if it's depletion of assets, if you didn't get the top dollar that you might have been able to get on some kind of an investment, then what they're going to argue is our damages are that we could have or should have been able to get more money. Those are damages. Those aren't benefits due.
Well, they are benefits due. I mean, they want their benefits, and in some ways it doesn't matter to them if the company has just arbitrarily decided it doesn't feel like paying or whether it's dissipated its assets or whether some other, you know, somebody's absconded with all of their money. I mean, you can imagine, and we see many different contexts. The bottom line is, though, I think these people who thought they were under the plan want their benefits. They were hoping to get, you know, 100 cents in the dollar.
But aside from arguing, and you can certainly argue an alternative, that maybe there was some kind of contractual provision, they've clearly gone beyond that to arguing that they had advices given to them and how this would operate.
And what document are you relying on for that?
It's even in the Waters case. Let me give you this, where that's cited. In paragraph 17 through 20 of the complaint, that's in Federal Appendix 375 through 378, it alleges that irrespective of the terms of the partnership agreement, Anderson engaged in his custom and practice, made affirmative representations in terms of how the plan would operate, and they swept in the all-encompassing and other conduct. And as a result, that they relied on that conduct. You know, the contract isn't an issue of reliance. This is a duty. This is advices. And the federal policy specifically, in terms of the coverage, covers administration of a plan, which includes advising the claimants.
Let me ask you the other way around, though. It seems to me, on your rationale, there is no case in which ERISA plan benefits, we'll assume this is an ERISA plan or any plan benefits, aren't paid that a policy like this wouldn't cover. Because as you just said, people are always going to make an argument that some conduct has caused this not to be done. And if that's the case, then aren't you falling into the moral hazard trap that companies just don't need to pay because, of course, their insurance companies will cover whatever it is they didn't pay in the end as soon as the inevitable lawsuit comes along?
But what I think is a big difference from other cases is in other cases you have things like payroll deductions, contributions, monies that are put into a plan that are funded and vested. And then there's these constructions of whether or not how much is owed and how much is not owed. There were no such monies here. This was a completely discretionary payment that was subject to being terminated. It would be decided upon.
We're back to the fact that that's your view of the contract, not the plaintiff's view. The problem that worries Judge Wood, and it worries me too, is that as long as the plaintiffs can claim entitlement, it looks like, on your perspective, the insurance company is on the hook substantively. That creates a moral hazard problem, and it would, in fact, destroy the insurance market. It's not clear how people in Arthur Anderson's position in the future could benefit by completely eliminating this entire insurance market.
But I don't see that you're ever going to have this situation which Anderson faced. These were discretionary payments. This is not something that existed as in a time. And I understand that there's some dispute over that. But what the claimants were actually saying was, even regardless of this, basically you advised us in such a way that we relied on that and
right.
We suffered damages.
And that's a routine claim. And I guess, you know, you say this is such a unique plan, and I'm just casting my mind over various plans I've seen over the years, and it seems to me off the cuff that there are some plans that are either 100% or some subset of the plan is employer-funded in exactly the same way the Arthur Andersen plan is. So I don't have any data or statistics at my fingertips to support or refute your claim that this is such an unusual thing. I'm not sure that it matters whether the contributions that fund the plan come entirely from the employer, as this one did, or whether they're partly employee contributions and partly. That sounds like a plan detail to me that doesn't address the fundamental problem here.
Well, what I see happening is you have the claimants saying that even if Andersen is right in their filings and in these complaints, even if Andersen is right, based on how we were advised that this plan would operate, we relied on that and then suffered damages, which I think is a different scenario. And that's exactly what Federal promised to cover. If you're going to mismanage assets, if you misadvise, its administration in the federal policy is defined to include the advising of the employees. If you misadvise people,
well, that's exactly what the policy covers. It covers breach of fiduciary duty. That's why I ask whether any of the payments in the Waters suit could be understood to represent breach of fiduciary duty as opposed to the underlying benefits that the plaintiffs claimed.
Yes.
And how so?
That's based on the paragraphs that I cited in the complaint, 17 through 20, in that what they were arguing was a custom and practice existed, that representations were made to the claimants as to how this would operate. They were misadvised as to...
I don't understand how that amounts to the assertion that these damages represented, that these payments represented damages for breach of fiduciary duty as opposed to a portion of the underlying payments. A different way to look at this is that this is your classic bank run situation.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't...
This is a bank run situation. Arthur Andersen has a liquidity crisis. It can't pay currently all of its obligations. And therefore, everybody with an obligation demands immediate payment, demands acceleration. Now, of course, the fiduciary duty of the money manager in a bank run situation is to pay no one currently and to prorate all the claims. On that understanding, what Arthur Andersen did was consonant with fiduciary duty. Very hard to see how there could be damages for breach of fiduciary duty. That's why I'm looking for some reason to suppose that the payments in Waters were for breach of fiduciary duty as opposed to a prorated portion of the actuarial value of the pension claim.
I think, Your Honor, you're absolutely right, because what the claimants were saying was because there is a fiduciary duty, we go to the front of the line.
Yeah,
it's not a proration.
I don't think you understand what I'm saying.
May I have the question back again, please?
No, go ahead.
You have also, based on the Penda decision, the Wilkin decision, and Benoit Motors, that where there are allegations, as there were in Buchholz and Bryce, that clearly fall within the potential coverage of the federal policy, that those also have to be taken into consideration with related claims, such as Waters and the other claims that followed. And in those, in Bryce, even Federal concedes that there are allegations of breach of fiduciary duty. That's contained in the Bryce suit complaint, as well as what became the Bryce arbitration.
I thought those were not actually carried forward into the arbitration. I thought the arbitration was focused much more on benefit recovery. In fact, exclusively on benefit recovery.
Actually, the Bryce arbitration was nothing more than a one-page letter that was attached to the Bryce complaint, because the Bryce complaint basically was filed in aid of arbitration. And so it said, based on what's in the Bryce complaint, we are going to pursue arbitration. And at that point in time in this jurisdiction, there was a question of whether or not you could have a class-wide arbitration or whether Andersen was literally facing hundreds of individual arbitrations over that issue. With respect to the Waters and the judgment and the defense amounts, I'd like to get back to the duty to defend. Federal supposedly said it agreed to defend some of these matters, and yet here we find ourselves today, 6 years later, and defense amounts are still disputing and not paying on Waters. They don't want to pay defense amounts related to Colley. They don't want to pay defense amounts related to Veets. So to the extent they're trying to say that at some point in time we supposedly agreed to do this, You have to, under Illinois law, WASA decisions and others, you have to take substantive steps. And if you do not, then you're in breach and you're stopped to deny coverage. And under WASA, there isn't an exception, as federal claims here, for some kind of argument of non-coverage. And that is clear from WASA, which recognizes only one exception. It's not the exception that we have here.
So in my fire insurance policy, if Anderson had decided to throw into the hopper a claim for fire damage to one of its offices, you think federal would also have had to pay that?
Well, I think, number one, if you'd have to look at whether or not there was a duty to defend. I'm not sure that a policy.
Well, but under this policy, you say that federal breached its duty to defend under this policy, and it's therefore stopped to object to paying whatever you tender to it. And so that's why I'm asking.
I don't think it's whatever you tender. There's a difference between estoppel on non-coverage, arguing that something is not covered, and taking the platinum situation, which is the separate issue of the reasonableness of the settlement.
See, I think federal would agree with you on that. There is a difference between estoppel in the sense of being a stop from an ability to rely on something in the policy that might excuse payment, and just a flat-out non-coverage, whether it's the trademarks and platinum, or they would argue here, whether it's my fire hypothetical. We need to decide on which side of the line this falls.
Yes, Your Honor. And what happens here, though, is, as in platinum, there was a reasonableness of the settlement issue. Federal here did not dispute below whether or not the settlements were reasonable.
You didn't bring them in at all to the settlement process, as I recall. You presented them with a fait accompli of here's the settlement, chip in your $25 million, right?
Actually, no, they were invited, and the settlement was not effectuated, and they were asked to participate, and they decided not to participate. They were given every opportunity to participate.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Kunstein?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. Just want to respond to a couple of points and then elaborate a little bit on the waters issue, because I think that it actually is fairly illuminating here. First, in terms of where Anderson was, Anderson was fully protected. Anderson had its counsel designated. Anderson had its counsel working on the case long before federal even knew that these cases existed. Federal agreed to defend the Waters case and the other cases of which it got notice in September within 2 months after it had that notice. And then within 3 months, federal filed a declaratory judgment action. I think, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, what you were referring to with regard to the fact that the declaratory judgment action stays essentially the insurer's obligation to pay is the certain underwriters case. There's other case law, I believe, but that's a recent case that's cited in our brief. And moreover, this was a legal action in which federal had the right to agree to defend, but it also had the right to file a declaratory judgment action for the court to make a determination as to whether or not it in fact had that obligation. The court made a determination in this case. That case was part of a proceeding that was then appealed. Federal posted an appeal bond. That's all entirely proper, both under the procedures of this court and the federal courts, and also under the procedures that are set forth in certain underwriters and other cases. Once federal filed a declaratory judgment action, it was on the hook to pay the money. But the question is whether the hammer of estoppel can come down on federal's head, if you'll pardon the analogy or the metaphor, and force it to give up all of its coverage defenses under the policy. Now, with regard to Waters, my friend cited paragraphs 17 through 20 as an indication that there was something here more than a breach of contract claim, that there was somehow a breach of fiduciary duty or misrepresentation involved. The paragraphs that are cited are within count one of the Waters complaint. And count one of the Waters complaint is denominated breach of contract. And several paragraphs after that, it goes on to say, is the last paragraph of that section, as a direct and proximate result of defendant's breaches of the partnership agreement, plaintiffs have been denied the funds held in their capital account, et cetera, and that is their sole ad damnum within that provision. Essentially, what the Waters claimants were saying, and this was all of the other complaints as well, were, yes, representations were made to us, customs and practices existed, and those became part of this contract, just as in the Kruger case, a recently decided case by this court, where the court said, it's not a separate misrepresentation claim to be told that to allege that someone told you that a contract was going to be interpreted in a certain way if that person was speaking on behalf of the company. And here, the only allegation is that these representations came from the partnership. So fundamentally, this is nothing but a breach of contract claim. Now, the Waters case has three other state common law accounts stated open book account and money lent, but they're all in the nature of that same kind of state law obligation to pay. In fact, if it's discretionary, why did they pay? And the fact is that they didn't believe this to be completely discretionary. They believed there was a likelihood that they would have to pay it at the end of the day. Now, Your Honor mentioned the moral hazard issue. Of course, moral hazard informs all of this. The May case is very much on point in establishing why this kind of payment is not considered a loss.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.